Next, I'm delighted to introduce one of our distinguished keynote speakers, a Canadian who has given a real chance to the question, could we have an economy that would be slower by design and not by disaster? Please welcome the author of Managing Without Growth, Professor Peter Victor from York University.
Well, good morning, everyone. It's a real pleasure to be here. Thank you, Madam Permanent Secretary, for such an inspiring opening presentation. I thought for a minute you'd seen my notes and were reading them out. But it's clear that there is a certain common theme that's emerging in the discussions that are taking place in places like this and in other parts of the world about growth and about degrowth. So what I'm going to do this morning in my 35 minutes or so is to touch on some of the main points that I address in my book, Managing Without Growth, and in the hope that it will help seed a fruitful open dialogue amongst us all later on. What I'm planning to do is to cover the following 9 points rather quickly. The first is to emphasize that the economy is a subsystem of the biosphere, and if we lose sight of that, then we will have a hard time solving our problems. Secondly, just to point out that the economy is placing an excessive burden on the biosphere, and that's why we have to reconsider the question of growth. Thirdly, a few comments about technology. Some people think that technology can provide the complete answer to our problems. I don't think that's true, and I'll illustrate that with some examples. The result being that we must address not just how efficiently we run an economy or the intensity with which we produce, say, greenhouse gases in relation to economic activity. We also have to address the scale of our economy, this question of growth. I'll just point out in passing that many are questioning growth. When I started out just a few years ago working on this, I don't think that was the same at all, but there's a mushrooming of interest, which I'm very happy about. Because there are such extreme global inequalities, I just want to emphasize that my focus on managing without growth is directed specifically at countries like mine, Canada, or I suppose Finland, or the rich countries, which I believe have to go first in this regard. Then I'll report to you on some of the simulation work I've done just to sort of show what we can see through the use of computer models to see, well, what kind of outputs are possible, outcomes are possible in an economy that's not growing. Finally, raise the question, well, can we adapt to a very different kind of economy? I think that's a very big question that I can only give you a little bit of the answer to. So that's really what my presentation is about. Now, I'm going to start with this rather beautiful picture of our planet. This is our home. It's where we all live. It's where we are right now, of course. The problem is we're just not taking proper care of the planet in terms of the numbers of humans and the way we lead our lives. The global impacts are now getting untenable. Another beautiful graphic is this one, which shows the biomass of the planet expanding and contracting on a seasonal basis. This is one of the more visible cycles happening on the planet that humans are interfering with. This is a big problem for us, and we have to work out how to run our economies so that we don't keep disturbing and upsetting these cycles on which we depend. Now, as I said briefly in the introduction, I am an economist, so I come at these issues with the perspective of economics. And I have to say that I'm rather envious of people who have a natural science background and are used to seeing these kinds of graphics rather than the kind that we use in economics. Those of you who've studied some economics or even teach economics would be more familiar with something like this. This is the way economists present an economy to incoming students. It's the interaction between firms and households. The firms supply the goods and services. The households supply the so-called factors of production. And the goods and services flow in one direction. Money flows in the other direction. Economists spend a lot of time understanding the system, and the work is very interesting. But if you want to appreciate the way in which the economy interacts with the natural environment, this is hopeless, because there is no environment. What I do as an ecological economist, along with others of the same outlook, is to add in a lot of what's missing. So the first thing is to note that as a subsystem of the biosphere, the economy depends upon nature to provide us with the materials and energy that keep the economic system going. We also know from fundamental physical laws that all of the material and energy that enters the economic system is disposed of as waste back into the environment. So we have a problem on the resource side if we have too great a need for the resources, and we have a problem on the receiving side, on the waste side, that we use the environment as our waste dump. If we overload the capacity of the environment to absorb our waste, then we start interfering with these biophysical cycles, which can feed back on the capacity of the biosphere to provide us with the, now, as they're called, ecological goods and services on which we and the economy depends. And all that takes place on planet Earth. And all that's entering there, of course, is solar energy and the waste heat is leaving. Now, in my view, unless we understand the economy as fundamentally embedded in the biosphere, we will not make progress in dealing with the problems that have brought us here today. Sadly, this isn't the common view. It's an increasingly popular view, but it's not the common view of economists. I'm going to give you another graphic which says much the same thing in a different way. This is a representation of what we now refer to as the real economy. In the recent recession, there was a lot of talk about the real economy, the financial economy. Much of economics is focused on the real economy. That's that centerpiece in the diagram I showed you before. Ecological economists understand that the real economy depends upon the natural economy to provide the materials and energy and to receive the wastes. But I think to date, ecological economists haven't fully appreciated that there is this third economy, which we might call the financial, which interacts with the real economy through finance, through credit. And what is lacking is a complete understanding of how these three economies interrelate to one another. And I think that should be part of the research agenda of many of us. Now, here's part of the problem, and that is that a lot of economics is discussed as if that bottom layer, the natural world, doesn't really exist or doesn't matter. And so economics is conducted as if what matters is the real economy and the financial economy, and this is what we've seen in the discussion around the recent crisis. If this is your worldview, then it's not surprising that you think that growth can continue forever and ever, because you've lost sight of the dependence of these systems on the natural world. However, the view that economic growth is a major priority of government and was adopted by governments as their policy is really quite recent. This is a picture of the initial meeting of the OECD Council in 1960, and it was really at this time that Western governments adopted the pursuit of economic growth as their primary economic policy objective. That's not that long ago. I can't clearly see the faces of the people in this room, but I'm sure many of us remember 1960, and yet we tend to think that economic growth and its pursuit has always been the number one priority of governments. Well, that's just not the case. It goes back about 50 years. Now, what's the problem with this? Well, the first thing is that we are now clearly placing excessive burden on the environment to support all of this growth that we've been in pursuit of. This now quite well-known diagram comes from an article in Nature late last year, points out 9 areas where we are either exceeding the safe operating capacity of the planet, as indicated by the green circle in the middle, or we are threatening to do that with respect to each of those issues. I won't read them all out, but you can see climate change, biodiversity, the nitrogen, the phosphorus cycles, and so on. How did this come to pass? Well, one way of answering that question is to look, as I've said before, at how much material and energy we use to drive our economies. If you look at the data from 1900 to 2005, this is what you see. For the first 50 years, the amount of materials, and this includes fossil fuel as a material, because it enters the economy as a material first, the amount doubled over the first 50 years of the 20th century. But in the second 50 years, look what happened. It increased by 700%. Now, all of that material essentially flows through the economy back into the environment, so it's no surprise that we're now seeing these pressures on the global systems. One key problem that we're facing is this one of peak oil. There's debate about the timing, but there's not much debate anymore about the reality of peak oil. If you look at this graph, what it shows you is that the peak year of discovery was in the 1960s. In other words, more conventional oil was discovered in the 1960s than ever since. There's been discoveries, but on an annual basis, they've been in decline. Meanwhile, the green line shows the increase in the use of oil, and in the early 1990s, we started using more oil on an annual basis than was being discovered. And as Colin Campbell, the originator of this graph, says, you can't produce oil you haven't found, and so at some point the production of conventional oil must decline. Some are saying it's already happening, others are saying it's going to happen within the next 10, 15 years. One thing we know is we've got to make a very quick energy transition, much quicker than we've ever seen in the past, and that will be a major challenge among all the others that we face. Now, as to the question of whether technology can save us, let me give you some illustrations to cast doubt on this proposition. This is what a computer looked like in the year I was born, 1946. It took a lot of people working very hard, operating large equipment to get it to do some very simple calculations. And I guess the world was very dismal in those days. It was black and white. By 1970, this was the year I was doing my PhD. The computing power was much, much larger, much more powerful, and color had entered the world, and we could do so much more. Now, I want to just say something about the year 1970. It's as far in the past as 2050 is in the future. Now, if you remember 1970, it just doesn't seem that long ago. And yet, we talk now about all of the changes we have to achieve in the next 40 years. It just kind of puts this in perspective, that we don't have a lot of time. By 1992, which is the year that students coming into our universities now were born, this is what a computer looked like. And right now, this is a typical computer of the 2010s. Now, what's going on here with computing is miniaturization. And this is just one example. I could point to telephones, of course, as another example. There's a tendency to think that miniaturization automatically reduces the burden on the environment. But one of the things that miniaturization has made possible is the construction of very, very massive equipment. For example, you couldn't design, build, or even operate a truck of this magnitude without miniaturization, without computers. This is the world's largest earth-moving machine, an absolute monstrosity. But again, it's miniaturization that makes this kind of technology possible. This is a pretty impressive landscape, and then they added this building. And because of a software problem, it couldn't operate for the first couple of weeks because it couldn't run the elevators. But it just shows you that miniaturization, again, is allowing, I won't say maximization, but massive, massive technology. And my final example, the one that in a sense amuses me the most, is this. This is a picture of the world's largest cruise ship. What is amusing about it is what the project engineer has to say about it. I would say that this is the most environmentally friendly cruise ship to date. It is much more efficient than other similar ships. Now, what, of course, they mean is if this ship is full, on a per-person basis, it doesn't use so much energy to move around the world. But you'd land one of these on a Caribbean island, that's what they do, and 4,000 or 5,000 people get off at the same time. It doesn't look very environmentally friendly to me. One way of interpreting this is, as the permanent secretary mentioned in her remarks, is through the rebound effect. This is a graphic showing a car. If we make this car more efficient, we would expect it to use less energy. And in a sense, it will. But there are other factors to take into account. First of all, that if the car is more efficient, it costs less to run. If the car costs less to run, you can expect the driver to drive further than they otherwise would, and therefore use more energy, not necessarily so much more that it negates all of the efficiency saving, but at least it reduces it. That's the direct rebound effect. But it may also take more energy to build the energy-efficient car in the first place, and there's been some controversy about the Prius in this regard. Plus the fact that if you do save money from having a more efficient car, what do you do with your savings? Well, if you take a holiday in Spain, you may very well find that you now have overwhelmed the gains from the energy-efficient car, and as a result, the rebound effect has more than negated the gains. This is a big problem, and it's a structural problem, because one of the driving forces for improvements in energy efficiency is, in fact, to increase scale. So it's not an unfortunate coincidence. There's a link phenomenon going on here. So the conclusion that I draw from this is that we must address the scale of our economy as well as intensity, as well as the impact per unit of economic output. And here's a graph which highlights that. This is a graph which shows energy use from 1980 to 2005. And the heavy line in the middle shows that energy use overall globally has risen in that period. The line which declines is the energy intensity line, and it shows us on a per unit of economic output basis, we use less energy than we ever did before. This is very good news. But that decline has been overwhelmed by the increase in the scale of the world's economy, and so the overall effect is that we use more energy than ever. The key message is that it's both scale and impact that matter. If you look at materials use, you get exactly the same picture. Materials intensity has declined overall, but at a slower rate than overall output has increased, with the result that overall materials has increased. So we have to address scale as well as intensity. In other words, we have to look at the growth question. Now, we're not alone. Many people are questioning growth. One way of illustrating this is with a few news clippings from various parts of the world, mostly North America and Europe. These go back just a year or two. That's the Montreal Gazette, the Toronto Globe and Mail. This is Harper's Magazine, the fear of fallowing that they wrote about. There's the Wall Street Journal, New Limits to Growth, Reviving Malthusian Fears. Here's Paul Krugman, the Nobel laureate in economics, talking about running out of planet to exploit. New Scientist have a whole issue on the folly of economic growth. And so it goes on, many of these articles. Here's Spiegel looking at, can economies function without growth? Even The Economist, the last Christmas edition, talked about progress and its perils. Now, many of us, including your three keynote speakers today, have written books addressing these issues. I'll just mention one of the books, but the others are great too. But I will mention Tim Jackson's report that he did for the UK Sustainable Development Commission, an excellent report, but significant also because it was commissioned by a government, and I think that was a very big step forward. Here's a report from the New Economics Foundation, Growth Isn't Possible. Here is on Facebook, the Center for the Advancement of a Steady State Economy, and here's something from the Barcelona Degrowth Conference. So you see there's a very big conversation happening now, and it's great to see so many people here to join that. The final point I want to make before I get to some of the modeling work I did is just to report to you on this fairly new happiness literature. This is a graph which on one axis shows the scores that different countries have obtained when their residents respond to questions about how happy they are. There's all sorts of methodological problems with such work, but it's one way of gauging how happy different people are. And on the horizontal axis is a measure of income. And what you see is that sort of pattern, that when people are poor and get a bit richer, yes, it really shows up in their self-reported status of happiness. But beyond a certain level, getting richer doesn't seem to register in the way people report their sense of well-being. That's a comparison at the same point in time. If we do a comparison over time, as has been done for the United States, going back from 1945 pretty much to the present day, this is what you see. The blue line shows gross domestic product per person in the United States, and the purple line shows the percentage of Americans who consider themselves very happy. And you can see over that period, the two lines more or less moved in much the same way. But after that, look at this complete divergence. Percentage who declared themselves very happy, if anything, declined, whilst there was tremendous growth in GDP per capita. This finding has been repeated in other places too. A totally different way of coming at the same question of the relationship between economic growth as conventionally measured and well-being is to look at the genuine progress indicator. This is a metric which attempts to fix GDP, to make it a more reliable measure of well-being by taking out some of the things in GDP that have no bearing on well-being and adding in things like the value of volunteer work that aren't in GDP, which do have a bearing on well-being. This is what you see, again for the United States, that for the first 50 years, these two lines move together, the GDP per capita being the upper line and the genuine progress indicator being the lower one. But after about 1970, the lines completely diverge. And what I find intriguing is that this is so similar to the happiness literature, and yet the methodologies are wildly different, and yet the results are much the same. Okay, I did say it early on, and I'll just do this with one slide. There are extreme global inequalities justifying, I think, putting the onus on countries like ours to go first. And one way of illustrating this is to look at the weekly food consumption of a family in each of four countries. In the top left-hand corner, it's a German family. The top right, it's a family from Ecuador. The bottom left, it's a family from Bhutan. And the bottom right, it's a family from Chad, and you can see the massive difference in the amount of food these families are planning to eat in a week. And although I try to be as scientific as I can, I know it's not scientific just to point out that the only family that's not smiling is the family in the top left-hand corner. In my quantitative work, I set out to answer a particular question. I said, could we have full employment, no poverty, fiscal balance, reduce greenhouse gas emissions without relying on economic growth? And to try to get some insight into that, I developed a macroeconomic model of the Canadian economy, which I call LOGRO. And you might like to know that the answer to that question is, yes, you can. Well, you can do it on the computer. Whether we can do it in real life is a bigger challenge. So just to tell you quickly about the model, looks at what makes an economy grow, represents that with a variety of equations, and then simulates some of the outcomes. So what does make an economy grow? Well, one way of looking at that is to look at what we spend money on. That's, of course, what GDP measures. It measures what we spend on consumption in the stores, what we spend on investment. This is through businesses buying new equipment, what government spends on goods and services, and if we run a trade balance. Those are the components of gross domestic product, and each of those appear in LOGRO. We can also look at the capacity of an economy to produce the output that we require. And in the simplest possible terms, that depends upon the labor force, the size of the labor force, and its level of skill, and the capital equipment that labor has to work with, and then all the factors that go into productivity, the technology, the organization, and so on. And in LOGRO, all of these things appear. When I run the model forward for 30 years, from 2005 to 2035, and say, well, what would the Canadian economy look like over that period if it performed much as it had done in the previous 30 years, something which, by the way, I don't think is going to happen, but it's not a bad starting point. This is what the result looks like. The top black line shows you gross domestic product per person. Everything here, by the way, is indexed to 100, starting from the year 2005. That's a lot of economic growth that would have Canadians living about twice the GDP per capita at the end of that period that they have at the beginning. Greenhouse gas emissions would continue to rise. Unemployment fluctuates a little bit. The government's fiscal position improves. This, by the way, is all governments in Canada together, not just the federal government, but it's our federal, provincial, and municipal governments combined. But even with all this economic growth, there's something very, very disappointing here, apart from the greenhouse gas story, and that is that the poverty index, the brown line you see there, which is the UN's human poverty index, consisting of an income measure, an adult illiteracy measure, and a longevity measure beyond the age of 60, shows that the number of poor Canadians would increase over this period, largely because there'll be more Canadians. But even the percentage of Canadians in poverty wouldn't decline, even with all that economic growth, if we simply repeat the pattern of the past. But now, what would happen if we take growth out of that system? If we eliminate all of the growth drivers on consumption, investment, government, you can read them all there. So what I then did, I said, okay, well, starting in 2010, I'm going to eliminate all of the growth in the economy over a 10-year period. So after 2020, there's nothing driving the economy to larger heights. And you'd expect it to be disastrous. At least I expected it to be disastrous. And in fact, that's exactly what it is. Unemployment goes off the top of the graph. The poverty index gets very high. The government's fiscal position, the red line, gets completely untenable. At the very end of this scenario, you can see that GDP per capita has finally leveled off, and greenhouse gases have come down somewhat. But this is a disaster scenario. This is a terrible outlook, and it's the kind of scenario that has everybody very concerned when we even have the kind of recession that we've been going through the last couple of years. The question, therefore, is, can we do better than that? And as I said, many people are sort of asking this kind of question. Here's Larry Elliott, the economics editor of The Guardian, who says, is it possible to have to challenge the growth at any cost model and come up with an alternative that is environmentally benign, economically robust, and politically feasible? I don't really dwell in political feasibility very much, so I'm happy to talk about that. But I do think that if we can show that there is an environmentally benign and economically robust alternative, then at least it has a chance of political feasibility. So here's a better scenario. Again, I introduced a number of changes from 2010 onwards. They take 10 years to get fully implemented, and this is the result. And you'll see that in this scenario, the rate of growth of the black line, GDP per capita, slows down until it's zero. So from about 2028 onwards, there is no economic growth in the system. But look at what else is happening. The blue line, the unemployment rate has come down. It would be lower than Canada has experienced for the last 50 years. Greenhouse gas emissions have come down very significantly. The Human Poverty Index, the brown line, would give us perhaps the lowest poverty level in the world if we were to follow this path. And still the government pays its way. The debt-to-GDP ratio is looking pretty healthy. How do you bring this about? Well, this is a long story. I'll just give you a few points. Some of these points come directly out of the simulation. Some are sort of pretty obvious things that complement it. The first is we have to change the way we define success. If we define success as the increase in GDP per capita, this isn't very successful. But if we define it in terms of these much more important social and economic objectives, like full employment, like no poverty, then we can do a lot better. We have to impose limits on the extent to which we interact with nature. We have to discipline ourselves much more than we've done to date in terms of the burden we place on the natural systems on which we depend. We can use the price system to help us. I think a carbon price is fundamental, and it's a carbon price that's in the model that has brought the greenhouse gas emissions down in this scenario. But if we also have these stricter limits on the way we access resources and dispose of wastes, then it'll make all the prices within the economy a lot more meaningful, and I think we can put the market system to good use in that way. This scenario assumes a stable population. That would be quite a radical move in Canada, but it's one of the requirements to have no growth without having a declining GDP per capita, and also a stable labor force. We definitely do need a more efficient capital stock, and some of that is allowed for here. The way that the unemployment rate comes down without economic growth is that we work less. I mean, the increase in productivity has always offered us two choices. One is to produce more, working just the same, or to work less and not to produce more. We've sort of taken a combination of both. In this scenario, we would take all of the benefits of increased productivity in terms of a shorter work year. To deal with poverty, well, I don't have to say it in this country, but I still have to say it in my own, trickle-down doesn't work. You do need targeted anti-poverty programs, and this scenario provides for those. We have to move away from trying to demonstrate how good and how wonderful we are by the goods that we purchase. Part of the answer to that is to do something about advertising so that it's more informative and less whatever you'd like to call it. In my own sphere, education, I think we have to get back to educating people for life, not just for work. And now in the last part of this, I want to talk about a degrowth scenario. When I wrote my book, I was quite content to look at slowing growth to zero. When I encountered the idea of degrowth, well, it suggested to me, what can we achieve if the economy is actually smaller than it is today? This is a much more demanding objective. So what should a smaller Canadian economy look like? Well, I approached it in the following way. I said, well, what's the maximum size of economy the world can sustain? And to answer that, I looked at the ecological footprint. And the last year when the world's ecological footprint just equaled the world's biocapacity was 1980. So I took that as the year that we had a global GDP that you might say was sustainable. I then observed that a good chunk of the ecological footprint is due to carbon emissions. If we had lower carbon emissions, we could in fact have a larger economy. So I just picked a 40% reduction in emissions, which would allow the economy in fact to be considered sustainable at the level it was in 1999 at $30.5 trillion. Well, what would be the maximum average GDP per person? Well, that depends upon how many people you have. So I optimistically said, well, let's suppose the population of the world could stabilize at 8 billion, in which case that would give us a sustainable per person gross domestic product of $3,800. So I said, well, could we get the Canadian economy down to that level? That's a big drop. I thought in 30 years it wasn't very likely at all, so I picked not that number, but something four times that number, and said, well, wouldn't it be something if Canadians could get down to only four times the sustainable level of GDP per person? And even that's very demanding, as you'll see. By the way, that's if we were at four times that average sustainable level, it would be where Canadians were in 1976. It wasn't actually that bad in those days. And then I did the simulation using the model to see what that might look like. And in fact, it is possible to create a degrowth scenario for Canada where we reduce our per capita income to about $15,000 per head and still reach some other important goals. Now here you can see the black line, the GDP per capita, declining after about 2012 as these measures come into place. You can see the unemployment rate still comes down. It bumps around quite a lot, but it still comes down. Again, it's through a reduction in average time spent at work. The poverty levels come way down. Greenhouse gases are way down, partly because the economy is smaller, but there's also a very large greenhouse gas tax at play here. And the government's fiscal position is still looking quite healthy. I'm now going to give you the last part of my remarks, which is really to compare these different scenarios. I've presented three to you. The business as usual scenario, this is GDP per capita. The business as usual scenario is the blue line. The low no growth scenario, where we stabilize, the second one I showed you is the red line. And the degrowth scenario is the yellow line. You can see the massive difference between the degrowth scenario and the sort of steady decline in growth until there's no growth and the business as usual scenario. If we look at the greenhouse gas emissions, again, you see major differences in greenhouse gas emissions. Under business as usual, they continue to increase. Under the other two scenarios, they decline, but much more significantly under degrowth. If you look at some of the drivers, what's happening underneath to make these differences, if you look at population in the business as usual scenario, the Canadian population continues to expand. In the other two scenarios, it stabilizes. In work time, in the business as usual scenario, I assume no change in the average time Canadians spend at work. In the slow no growth scenario, the red line, you see it's a 15% drop in the average work year. But in the degrowth scenario, in order to have low unemployment in a much smaller economy, on average, Canadians would have to work much less. Maybe a good thing, but it would require major changes to bring that about. Government expenditures, well, in the business as usual scenario, they increase significantly. Even in the low no growth scenario, they don't decline in absolute terms, which means you can pay for all of the things that we think government ought to be paying for. But in the degrowth scenario, major problems. The government can balance its budget, but it will be spending a lot less money. And that shows you the different assumptions about the greenhouse gas tax, a very steep tax. It's necessary in the degrowth scenario in order to supplement government revenues. Are these ideas really wacko? Are they really way out? I don't think they are. They might have been at one time, but to illustrate the fact that they are now beginning to enter the mainstream, here's a quote from Robert Solow, Nobel laureate in economics for his work on economic growth. Here's what he's quoted as saying in 2008. He's saying it's possible that the US and Europe will find that either continued growth will be too destructive to the environment and they are too dependent on scarce natural resources, or that they would rather use increasing productivity in the form of leisure. It's a very nice, neat description of the scenarios that I've presented to you. He goes one step further than I do in my book, but it's a topic that always comes up for discussion in forums like this. He goes on to say, no reason that capitalism could not survive with slow or even no growth. Well, that's coming from one of the founders of modern growth theory. Question I'm going to end with is, can we adapt? As individuals, we know we're a very adaptable species, but it's our institutions that are going to have to adapt. And I'm much less confident that they're capable of doing that. These are institutions very much of a kind you have here. There's a university there. There's commercial manufacturing. There's our parliament, our law court, the central bank, international institutions, religious institutions. Change within these kinds of institutions of the sort that implementation of those sorts of scenarios I've displayed today is a major, major challenge, and I don't know that we're up to it. If we don't adapt, then I do believe the outlook is very bleak. And some people ask me, since I've been working on these issues for so long, aren't I just terribly depressed and pessimistic? And I guess I'm not. Maybe I ought to be, but I'm not. I continue to do the work because I don't think this is the only future. I think there's a much brighter future out there, but it's going to require a lot of very exciting change. And I illustrate the brighter future with this picture. And that's the image that I'd like to leave you with. So thank you very much indeed.
Peter Victor, thank you very much. Yesterday, you had a meeting in the Finnish Minister for the Environment, and also with the Finnish Minister for Finance, Mr. Jyrki Katainen. What kind of reactions your models, and particularly perhaps these low and no growth and degrowth scenarios, have received here in Finland and in Europe generally?
Well, there's been a lot of interest in the models, generally speaking. I think that's because it's one thing to make the arguments about the need to question growth and to discuss what might be possible, but so much of economic debate is conducted in terms of models and measurement that if it's only a source of comfort to show that we can put together using reasonable assumptions combined with very traditional methods, come up with radically different alternatives. So the reaction I've received has been one of considerable interest, so much so that there's similar modeling work now being initiated in other countries. So then you ask about the reaction yesterday in Finland. The idea certainly came up about whether Finland should be doing something like this, and there are many other ways of coming at this, but doing some explicit quantitative modeling, and it was, I think, an idea that was well received at the ministry and with the Minister of Finance. Even he didn't turn it down.
Wow. I know you would have 100 questions to Peter Victor, but due to time constraints, we need to take the questions and answers in the panel discussion. So let's thank Peter Victor once more so we can then welcome him back again.
Thank you.